Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week I'm obviously very excited because I've got researcher and elite athlete Brianna Stubbs back on the podcast today, checking in before her recent Ironman competition in Santa Cruz, California. Since we last talked with Brianna, she's left HVMN and joins the Buck Institute for Research on Aging as lead translational scientist. There she'll be studying ketone biology and collaborating on some of the best research being conducted today with the mission of living better, longer. In this interview, Brianna and I talk about some of the latest studies on ketone metabolism, which continues to show promise for athletic performance, cognition, and cardiovascular health. She also notes where the research in this area is lacking and even contradictory. Brianna also shares her personal strategy for dosing the ketone monoester she helped bring to the marketplace. Just before we get into this week's interview with Brianna Stubbs, I would like to invite you to work with us. Over the past 5 years, we've helped over 1,500 athletes overcome chronic health complaints and improve performance. We've done free starter sessions with thousands more. You may have heard me mention our $10,000 program on the podcast. Before beginning our program, our clients frequently ask, "This all sounds fantastic, but have you got anything less expensive to start?" I get that. If we fixed your fatigue and improved your performance, our program would be worth 10x what it costs. Our client Tim Harsh is the founding CEO of Bay Area web analytics company Owler. Here's what Tim said on the podcast recently. "It's been a game changer for me. I'm feeling better than I have in years, and I attribute that to the program and working with MBT. The thing is, there's no way for you to know that's what you're going to get before the $10,000 financial commitment. So we've radically changed the way that we charge. Now you can get started with a $1,500 retainer. The retainer is used for one-on-one consultation time at $250 an hour, and a $45 a month service fee is to deliver phenomenal customer service. Additionally, you get labs at the same price we pay and any supplement you want at a 25% discount. You can cancel at any time, at which point we'll refund you the balance of the retainer. Best of all, you get access to our expert moderated forum and weekly open office hours session on Zoom without incurring billable hours. If you come to the front page of our website at nourishbalancethrive.com, you'll find a button to book a free starter session. During this session, we'll take a look at your history and share how we'd work with you. If you're not in the US, don't worry. Since we always work remotely, we can help you almost anywhere in the world. Now, over to the interview with Dr. Brianna Stubbs. Well, Dr. Brianna Stubbs, thank you so much for joining me once again, this time in Bonnie Doon.
I know. Well, I visited you before and I love to come back and be in the Redwoods, so it's always a pleasure.
What a difference from San Francisco was the last time we recorded.
And in fact, we met outside the offices in the Tenderloin, and that afternoon I actually took down a would-be mugger. Do you remember that was
the same
thing?
Yeah, I do remember. You're completely bonkers.
And we recorded this podcast. I was walking back from recording the podcast and someone thought they'd try and steal my phone, and they didn't realize that they were taking on the wrong lady, and got high tackled when he tried to steal my phone and ended up in the justice system.
Oh, really? And did you get your phone back?
Oh, yeah. Well, he didn't get away. He started running and I was like, "You want to run away from me?"
You're completely bonkers in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. How crazy is that? Yeah. You've absolutely... That's the thing.
When but you don't think when this kind of stuff happens.
Yeah,
you don't
get that.
Think.
I do.
Just the instant reaction was, "Come back, you little..."
Yeah.
Beep, you know. And
I think it's different though. When you're British, you don't realize that in America,
people
have guns in their freaking glove boxes in America. You can't do that. You can't flip people the birds when you're on your bike. Like, you can't do that.
I think it was just last week, there was a video that came out like the block up from where this incident happened with people opening fire, and you're just like, okay, stuff works different here.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Yeah, so that was last time. Hopefully after this podcast, we'll pass without an incident.
Yes.
Let's hope it's not jinxed.
I think you've got far less chance of having your iPhone stolen in Bonnie Doon.
Yeah, I think it'll be all right. I think the worst that could happen to me is one of your dogs will try and eat me.
No, they're good dogs. They won't eat
Or one of your kids.
Yeah, that's quite
possible. Probably a higher chance.
Yeah, they'll take your shoes. You'll go to do the triathlon.
And I'll only
tomorrow.
Have one shoe.
Yeah, exactly. They'll only be one shoe. So tell us about your triathlon racing. You're here in Santa Cruz to race Ironman Santa
70.3,
Cruz.
That's it. So I did my first full Ironman in July. That was unfortunately, a really fun experience. I was kind of hoping that it would be so that I didn't have to do another one. But
and where was that?
That was back in England. So I went back over there, and it was in Bolton, which to American people would be like saying you're going to do an Ironman in Fresno. People are just like, why are you going to Bolton? Why are you going to Fresno? It's sort of like, but it was a nice, the city was beautiful. There was a lot of support on the course, and on the standing on the start line was just super. There was this great energy that kind of carried you through the day. So I really enjoyed it, feeling pretty fit, came back and kind of regrouped a little bit. And this race is just down the road from where we live. And I absolutely adore Highway 1. It's got to be one of the most beautiful stretches of road.
Really? You're completely bonkers. As a mountain biker, I'm thinking, why would anyone ride a bicycle along Highway 1 when you can ride in the Redwoods?
I don't know. The Redwoods is beautiful. Well, the thing is, in California, we have all the variety.
I know.
You can ride in the Redwoods. But also today I was warming up on the course and I was going with the wind, but just pointing down, and there's the waves crashing on the ocean.
Yeah, cool.
And I'm zipping along. I don't know what it is in miles per hour, but I'm like nearly 40 kph and I'm in my aero position, and it just feels like you're about to take off. And that's a pretty awesome feeling. So there's just too many things that are good fun to do, right? It's fun to bomb down a trail on a mountain bike. It's actually kind of fun to put out like a gross amount of watts on a time trial bike, and with a tailwind, that's fun too. And
you're going to ride past Waddell Creek, which is one of the best places in the world to kiteboard, right?
Yeah.
You're going to go. So you turn around at Ana Nuevo, where all the elephant seals are. I've still never been there and seen the elephant seals.
It's a scenic course. It's really nearby. And with triathlon, just there's so much that goes into putting a race together that it's good to get a bit more experience. Mm. And I had a really interesting experience with the full Ironman swim, where I got so excited on the start line, and then you get in the water, and I'd been typically myself and sort of seeded myself with people who are a bit faster than me. And actually that was kind of claustrophobic. And so people all around, and people, I wouldn't have said that, you know, I didn't have people swimming on top of me or battering me. It wasn't really even that, but I was breathing a bit more often than I would in swim training. I was breathing every stroke rather than every three. And I feel like it was activating my deep brain stem, like panic center, or the breathing and not being able to see the horizon because of people. And there was just a lot going on.
It sounds terrible.
So I had to take myself out of the middle of the race and go off to the side and just sort of like put my head up for a few seconds and just be like, it's okay. This is a long day. You're not going to just like freak out in the first like 10 minutes of the swim. You got to swim for an hour. It'll be all right. Just stick near the edge. And then once I got into my rhythm, it was fine. But you can't practice swimming with 200 or 1,000 people. You can't practice swimming with that many people by yourself. Right. So I've actually done a fair bit of open water practice because I live by the San Francisco Bay, and there's a sort of sheltered cove. And, you know, I felt like I'd been pretty diligent, and I'd put in the hours in the pool with Leslie Patterson's guidance.
Yeah, we both coached with Les at Brave Art recently.
She'd put me through my paces. And I kind of felt like, you're pretty dialed in with the swimming, but you can't mimic that race situation.
No.
So I kind of figured, get a bit of swim practice, ride on Highway 1. It's kind of flat. Maybe I'll do a PR. And then, so the aim for tomorrow, and I feel like I've always been a little bit conservative on the bike, so I'm going to go and try and blow up on the bike and then see what I have left for the run. I don't know, like the race, the outcome doesn't matter so much to me, so I just want to push the envelope a little bit and see how it goes.
I think that's always a good way to go into a race. Like, you don't really give a shit about the... I've had some of my best... Les has talked about this as well. Like, you have some of your best results when the expectation is low. I can remember a couple of years ago, I did a race in Wilder Ranch, which is where you're going to be. And the week before, I got knocked off at the start and ended up with stitches in my arm.
Oh, no.
And so I did the race the week after thinking, well, this is not going to go well, is it? Because I've got freaking stitches in my arm. And of course, I got a much better result than I thought I was going to get. And I think that's a good way to go in.
Yeah, you know, set some process goals and the outcome will take care of it. So I kind of half hoping that the whole way along this, you know, triathlon journey, that I have been over conservative on the bike, and that I will, like, I think I'll get through the run no matter what happens. So I think it'd be good to put myself in the hurt locker a little bit and really see how it goes.
And what's it going to be like swimming in the open water in Santa Cruz? They've got big waves here.
Hopefully, because it's first thing in the morning, hopefully stuff won't have picked up just yet. We'll see.
It won't be windy as much. The wind picks up around midday.
Yeah.
But the waves, I don't know about that. Actually, at the harbour,
they'll be following me in. They'll be following me in on the way in. So as long as I can get out, then it's fine. I'll just hold on to someone's foot and they...
Talk about how you dose the ketone ester. That is, after all, what you're famous for.
Yeah.
Everyone wants to know.
I don't like, because I think partly because of that experience that I had on the Ironman UK swim, I feel like for me, the swim is like a bit of a vulnerable time. So I don't like taking anything, because sometimes when I take ketone ester, I feel kind of wired. and a bit like
over caffeinated. You know,
well, yeah, not over caffeinated, but I feel it's just like a bit of a different mind body sensation.
Right.
And so I don't want to throw that into the mix when I'm also a little bit like different mind body situation because of swimming. So I don't take it before the swim. I have it in transition one before the bike. And I think because the swim is shorter, it's not as depletive. And I take it alongside my like regular carbohydrate fueling. So in the morning before, I'll have like oatmeal, complex carbs, like slow release carbs a few hours before the race. And so then when I get to transition one, I'll have 1 to maybe 1.5 bottles worth of, so it's sort of 25 to 30 ish grams of ketone ester before I go onto the bike. I mean, I think, you know, I could, for the Ironman, I would re-up again halfway through or, you know, a couple of hours in. Mm. But for the half Ironman, I'll probably just box on. Doesn't taste great. So, you know, depends.
It still doesn't taste great, even though...
Well, I think HVMN revised the flavor. So people should go try it now because I think they got a new flavor that's apparently a little bit better. I'm waiting to try it.
Oh, you haven't tried it? Okay. And what do you think?
I tried it in development, but I haven't swigged a whole bottle of it yet.
Okay. And what do you think might be going on with what you said about the sort of overstimulated feeling that you can't quite put your finger on or even name? What do you have any idea what might be going on at the source code level there?
It's definitely something that other people describe when they take it, feeling like more behind their eyeballs or kind of energetic but not jittery. It's not unpleasant feeling. It's not like heart palpitations or dizziness or anything like that. Not for me anyway. I think everyone has a slightly different subjective experience, but it could be a combination of the elevated ketones and the switch from glucose as an energy source in the brain specifically. There's a number of different physiological things. So you're dropping blood glucose, you're raising blood ketones, and also you're actually giving yourself an acid load. So we see that people get mildly acidotic and that changes your PO2 and PCO2 balance, your arterial blood gas. So there's a number of like fairly fundamental parameters in your like basic physiology that shift a little bit. Mm. And so maybe if you go from a state of balance and then the balance is just sort of shifted, it just maybe you experience some kind of emergent sense of that shifting. Mm. And actually recently, the group that I did my PhD in over at Oxford, they published a paper that looked at using ketone ester as a tool to deliver an acid load during exercise and look at anxiety, the feeling of discomfort in your legs and with your breathing, and then your anxiety around about that. And so it was interesting because there were differences, they're not necessarily differences in discomfort or difficulty breathing, but differences in the anxiety starting to be teased out. And the lead investigator, let's just say, on that paper, Dr. Olivia Fall, did her PhD looking at the periaqueductal gray, so the fear center. I'm probably butchering it and she might kill me if she hears this, but she was interested in like the very, very primal parts of our brain and how that regulates anxiety. And so she, and then when she came and figured out like ketones could be a tool to manipulate that, she brought that expertise over and started to sort of uncover some kind of interesting differences there. So I think it's not much known about it, just that one paper. So maybe it's linked to that. I think there's certainly a story there. Like it's kind of the end of a thread and you pull up.
Yeah, exactly. There's just like, yeah, so many things.
Yeah.
So talk about your transition to the Buck Institute. That's very exciting. I feel like I've been there at the right time to record
these transitional
moments in both your sporting and your professional, well, I guess they're both your professional career, really. I can't really draw the distinction.
I wouldn't
there.
Say I'm a professional triathlete yet,
but I mean, certainly, I mean, you were just recently retired as in rowing when
I think I was still met. I think I was still competing when we first spoke, definitely deciding what I was going to do next. And yeah, it's been a bit of a journey since then. So yeah, I took a job as the lead translational scientist at the Buck Institute. So the Buck Institute, the mission is to live better longer. So it's dedicated to aging research, about 30 PIs, all of them working on different aspects of aging, reproductive aging, brain health and metabolism, and mitochondrial aging, some with disease focuses, some with more, you know, more basic science and mechanistic focuses. And it's a fantastic environment. I really missed being in a center of excellence. You know, when I was at Oxford, there were so many people working on a variety of different things, and it was really interesting to be a sponge there and soaking that all up. And so back at the Buck, I'm just sort of constantly surrounded by brilliant people, and I'm learning an awful lot. You know, to go back to what we were talking about at the start, it's certainly nice being in Novato halfway up a mountain in a beautiful Iampei crafted, you know, white stone building versus the Tenderloin. I have deer pop up outside my office. I have an office overlooking, you know, a flower bed, and the mother deer come and hide their baby deers right outside my window. So rather than looking at down and outs doing drug deals, I'm watching the...
Yeah, it could be more different, could it? No. I have been there. I sort of know what you're talking... Well, I do know what you're talking about, because I've been to the Buck Institute. I went there with Tommy to do Dale Bredesen's training.
That's
for his protocols.
He used to be the CEO of the Buck.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they've had some like fairly prestigious people be CEO there, because obviously Eric Verdin now, he's one of the leaders in NAD research, and also sort of ketone bodies are signaling metabolites as well. That's, you know, he's well known for that. So they're attracting more and more really great scientists. And so what took me there is specifically to work on ketone biology with John and Eric, John Newman and Eric Verdun. So they co-author this fantastic review that I'd really recommend that people read. It's talks about not only ketone metabolism, but all of the different receptor interactions that there are, and also the way that ketones affect epigenetics as well, and also how ketones themselves can be used as a post-translational modification and potentially affect protein function. So it's kind of different to the sports physiology background that I came from, but I'm interested, and they brought me on to help with the translation of this kind of ketone technology. And what's also great is I work a little bit with the technology transfer team there, and technology transfer, I think it's really important, and you know, people should celebrate it a bit more. The idea that you get a scientist and they can do some fantastic research, but that's no good if you can't get it out. Well, it's of limited use. It's of more use if you can take that discovery and figure out a way to get it out into the world. And you know, I was thinking the other day, as a scientist, you don't have those skills in legal matters, in branding and marketing, in maybe product development or software development, and you know, any discovery that you make as a scientist, and you're the world leading expert in that thing, but you need other people who are experts at all of the downstream things to actually make this a reality. And I think in a way Verta Health's a really good case study of this, right? We actually hosted Doctors Volek and Finney at the Buck the other day, and you know, they're both absolutely pioneers in the field of ketogenic diet research, but they need the team of software engineers, and they need, or it was helpful for them to have Sami Inkinen, you know, seasoned CEO, to help with the fundraising. And there's so much that goes into realizing an impactful discovery, helping it realize a full impact. And so part of what my job there is at the Buck is to help scientists figure out how they can make their ideas a reality.
That's very cool.
Which is cool. I get to speak to a number of the different PIs about the projects that they're working on.
Oh, so you better explain what a PI... You just used that word again.
Principal investigator.
Okay, so what does the principal investigator do?
So they're like the lab chief. So they're the one that will be on all of the, or you know, mainly on all of the NIH grants. So the sort of structure of a science lab is you might have your PI, your principal investigator. They're the one who the funding's attached to. They're generally faculty, so a professor of some kind, and they'll have tenure at the institute. And then you might have a couple of postdocs. So they've done their PhD and they're starting to do more independent research, but they're kind of past that like internship phase. Then you might have a lab manager who's not on an academic track themselves, but they might do more of the making sure supplies are stocked, but then also training people to do a certain procedure or experiment that the lab is known for. The PI will be writing grants, writing papers. The PI is probably not doing the experiments themselves.
Okay.
The postdocs and the lab manager will be like doing their own experiments, and the lab manager will be overseeing everyone. Then you have your PhD students, and they're, depending on where they are at their PhD at certain degrees of training, but that's even more of a training position, they'll end up with their degree. And then you might have research assistants or interns or staff scientists who are, well, actually they probably shouldn't bucket them all together. Research assistants and master's students would be at the very sort of outset of their scientific career, and they would need a lot of
mentorship. That's a very polite way of putting that. So have you made that mistake before in someone's career? It was very politically correct.
Yeah, we have to be, you know, I think I had some experience when I was doing my PhD of working with a master's student who I got to make up a buffer solution for me. Not a difficult thing. You give the kid the recipe, and all he has to do is like weigh it out. And we did this whole experiment and pipetting onto a 96 well plate, like four different things, you know, like a long, you know, a whole afternoon of experimentation, and it didn't work. And then I asked him to show me what he'd put in this recipe, and I mean, he'd mixed up NAD and NADH, Okay. But that's important because that drives the reaction in one direction or another. And so I was just like...
So my world of finance, that's like the trader telling me that I should buy something and then me going ahead and selling the same amount. You know?
Yeah. Yeah,
so the side matters.
I think you the research assistants and master students, you need to, they need a bit more supervision. They might do tasks that are less complicated. Uh-huh. They won't be setting their own like project direction. You'll be telling them what to do, but they're very helpful to help with the throughput of a lab, and you have to start somewhere.
So this is the same John Newman that was recently on STEM Talk.
Yeah, and he was the one that published the paper in the same issue of Cell Metabolism as Megan.
Yeah, so Megan was on. So John was episode number 94, and then Megan was episode 92. So this was this really interesting scenario where we had two people do basically the same experiment.
Well, slightly, it was really interesting in the episode of STEM Talk recently with John, he unpicked some of the differences between his work and Megan's work, which I thought was really, really useful because it showed how the two experiments together were even more powerful than just one of them by itself, and how they measured like slightly different things, and how that sort of like almost joint publication with slightly different methods really reinforces that the findings are, you know, well, reproducible, which in science is like not done all that often, is it really? So we have a reproducibility crisis in science. So it's kind of neat that those were done at the same time and had somewhat similar results. Mm-hmm. So I'm working with John Newman, and his background is in ketones specifically as a signal. So I think it was in 2010 or 2012, not all that long ago in science terms anyway. His group, he was at that point being mentored by Eric Verden, and they looked at BHB and its effect on histone acetylation. Mm-hmm. And so their research group was the first group to publish that BHB is an endogenous, so made in the body, histone deacetylase inhibitor.
Right.
And so when you have BHB present, you inhibit the histone deacetylases, so you get hyperacetylation of histones. Now, histones are, whenever people draw them in diagrams, they look like little balls, and they're protein, structural proteins that DNA is wound around. And so if your DNA was unwound, it's, you know, a meter or several meters long, and it's all packed down inside the nucleus, and that's because it's wound around these histones. And so by adding and removing these acetyl groups onto the lysine, which is an amino acid, if you add and remove these acetyl groups onto the lysines of histones, then that causes them to become a little bit less tightly wound. And then that means that the DNA reproducing machinery can get access to that bit of the DNA more or less, depending on how tightly it's wound. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, in short, BHB is affecting the ability of genes to be transcribed,
right.
And particularly genes associated with longevity and fat metabolism. And it's a kind of coordinated program of gene expression. And it's terrifically interesting because it could be, and it's likely different tissue to tissue. There's a lot of nuance that goes into this. And for me, it's one of the reasons why ketones are just so interesting, because it's this systems-wide effect. It's not only this presence of this substance as a metabolite and providing energy itself. It's not only doing that, but it also directly binds to receptors such as G protein couples receptor 41. There's actually a physical receptor on the cell surface, but then also having these epigenetic effects as well. So that's, they pioneered all of that work. It's been a great learning opportunity for me to see how they approach experimental design and to have people who can really stretch my thinking about ketones, because I definitely came at it more from a ketone is energy. I use energy. You know, like they're the more like basic and well-established view of ketone biology. So I actually got in touch with them a long time ago when I was at HVMN. And the way that I operate is to try and be friends with everyone. So I was in San Francisco at HVMN and they were in the Buck. And so I think I just reached out to them via email. I was like, hello, you know, I'm interested in ketones. This is what I've done, you know, in the Clark Lab. And I'm now commercializing ketonesses with HVMN. Can we meet? And they hosted me up at the Buck. And I think that they sort of earmarked me from then on. And so when they had an opportunity to sort of work on ketone biology with them, they approached me, and it was a tough decision to leave HVMN because I loved the company culture, and it was a huge privilege to see something go from being a lab chemical to being a Amazonable product. Yeah. You know, it's really cool, and I got to work with some of the best elite athletes in the world and some very elite military operators as well. So it was, you know, I wouldn't change anything that I'd done, and it was really tough. But I think for me, I I just love learning, and I'm a kind of, I'm not even a closet nerd. I'm just a nerd. I like that kind of thing. I like to be learning and stretched. And so the opportunity to go back and get my hands dirty with some science again has been really exciting.
That's amazing. Well, I want to come back to that. But before we get back to that, talk about some of these epigenetic effects of ketones. Is it all to the good? I start to get a little bit suspicious, you know, like yeah. It seems like everything they talk about is a good thing. Yeah. And there's this product on sale over here, by the way, right?
Yeah.
Like, has anyone found any signaling effects that seem to be deleterious?
So that was actually something that we were discussing the other day, thinking about broadly looking at ketone effects of ketone biology in a kind of an untargeted way. So one of the cool things about the buck is there's a mass spec core, so we can do very broad untargeted proteomics and metabolomics and omics wide looks at what's actually happening when you're in ketosis and the difference between diet and just having BHB through exogenous ketones as well, which is setup that's going to underpin a lot of our experiments going forwards, the difference between endogenous and exogenous ketosis, trying to isolate BHB effects. Mm. And then also another like underpinning crucial thread of the way we think about things is looking at RNS forms of, or D and L forms of BHB, the two optical isoforms, to tease out what's a fuel effect and what's a signal effect. Because in many cases, not all necessarily, and it's still something that we're kind of working out as we go, the S form will signal in a roughly similar kind of way to the R form. Sorry, just to confirm for your listeners, yeah, we use D and L or R and S. They kind of come as pairs, and I couldn't tell you why some people use one and not another. I always used to use D and L, but now at the buck people call them R and S.
Tommy has told me this before, and I'm kicking myself for not knowing. It's one of Greek derivation, and then the other is perhaps,
yeah. S is left, which is sinistra.
Okay.
If we're talking,
but it's the same thing. So it's basically like your hands, yeah, right? Like they're not perfectly.
You've got four fingers.
They're
and
not
thumb.
Mirror images. Yeah,
they overlay. They are equal to one another, but they don't overlay. So BHB has that property. So yeah, so that's sort of the way that we're approaching the whole field at the moment. Yeah, we don't know whether there's what's the balance of good and bad effects.
Okay.
And unfortunately, you know, I don't want to like sound like a stuck record for just how we approach everything. It's going to be all depending on your the context and the outcome that you're looking for.
Right.
So something that may, and actually this I think is a fairly well accepted paradigm right now, that a performance enhancing effect is likely to be deleterious for lifespan.
Okay.
Well, you know, so for lifespan, you want to slow down metabolism and not have mTOR activity and all of that. And then for performance and gain, you want rapid and efficient metabolism. You get, you know, when you're fasting,
but it isn't even that tissue specific, right? Like you, yeah, want you, yeah, want activation in the muscle
but not the liver.
Yeah. I don't want to slip up in the shower and break my hip, right? Yeah. Like that'll be the end of me, yeah, if I'm 70 years old.
Yeah, that just thinking about aging has been another really fun thing about working at the buck. I would not, especially having worked with athletes in the military, I wouldn't really necessarily have thought that much about getting old. I mean, I'm 28 myself. It's, uh-oh, just like,
Breeze's mindset started to shift. Like, wait, maybe I won't live forever.
Yeah. John Newman, so the PI of my lab, he's also a practicing geriatric physician,
oh, yeah,
at the VA in San Francisco. And so it's been really fascinating to learn about how complicated it is to manage conditions in elderly people, all of the comorbidities and also the trade-offs that you make, you know, what's most important to this patient and if they, right, lose and how much quicker they waste away or whatever, if they're immobile for a short amount of time and all of the social things that go around it. So it's definitely given me an appreciation for that branch of medicine, but also that branch of science. And it's interesting because the way from coming into the buck, you can see that geroscience, so the science of aging, is a very young field, much younger than human physiology or the kind of metabolism field, which I've been in up until this point. So it's interesting to see how rapidly everything's advancing and all of the different subfields that are emerging within that. For example, like cell senescence is something that we're at the buck very well known for. Judy Campisi, she's one of the world leaders in looking at cell senescence. And she didn't publish this, but interestingly, there was a paper published in the last year or so where a group showed that BHB could affect vascular senescence. So senescence of the balance of senescence and quiescence of cells in the cardiovascular system. So it's like there's lots of threads to pull on. And I guess for me, I'm always asking the question, like, how does all of this translate? Because it's kind of cool if it does something in a dish or in an animal model, but at what point can we start to see these things in humans? But I think, just to make sure I properly fully answer your question, I think it's like we're taking an approach where we're trying to watch for good and bad effects. We haven't yet. So I think the classic example of a negative ketogenic diet effect might be, say, the increase in uncoupling proteins that you get in the mitochondria that arguably make mitochondrial respiration less efficient, but that's good for some things and bad for performance. And it's not all going to be golden and roses.
But isn't that good for weight loss? If I'm trying to lose weight, I want to be inefficient, right? Like, I want to lose
burning calories,
a bunch of proteins as heat.
So what's the space?
Are any of these studies going to be done in humans? I'm kind of tired of hearing about studies done in a bunch of inbred male mice, and then you know, I'm supposed to get excited about that somehow. Do you think, is there any way that any of this research that I hear John Newman and Megan Roberts and others talk about, will it ever be translated into humans? Is it even possible?
With some good experimental design, you can do quite a lot. And, you know, I think that I think at the Buck, they don't have a clinical center right now, and I think it's something that they'd look at in the future, but it's definitely a different skill set to basic science. And I mean, it's hard. You can't take liver biopsies, and you could, you're more limited to the types of tissue you can collect and the amount of tissue that you can collect. So I think some mechanistic things do really need to be proven out in animals before you can get into people. But the Nature or the Science papers, often they'll tell a wonderful story from the basic mechanism up into animals, up into humans. Those are the very best papers. So it can be done. And I'm optimistic that we'll get
there. You think it's a valid concern then? I mean, you could just brush me off and say, no, Chris, you're an idiot. You don't need to do that experiment. We already know.
No, you definitely need to do it.
Okay.
I mean, one example, which I still don't really understand what's going on. I think we need to do more research, is there's so much, or there's a very strong consensus in the ketone research community that ketones help with inflammation because BHB inactivates the NLRP3 inflammasome.
Right.
And I've heard that to death, you know, and that was first demonstrated in 2013 by Deep Dixit in Yale. And that paper is cited a bunch of times. And since then, a lot of animal experiments have shown this effect. And so just assume that, like, it would carry, and also people on the ketogenic diet, they report less inflammation.
Right.
You know, it's like, okay, like, this is a thing.
They report everything. Weight loss, I can hold my breath longer. I'm winning Ironman triathlons, you name it.
It's panacea. But
the only thing that doesn't work is cyclocross.
you're the outlier. So I felt like this was fairly well demonstrated in animals. And then recently, two papers came out which seemed to be sort of suggesting the opposite. So one paper came out of a group in Copenhagen, and they infused, I don't know how they got ethics to this study, but they infused a bacterial toxin called LPS into healthy young men.
Right.
And then they also infused them with ketones on one arm.
Isn't this the one where the distribution was all over the place, right? Like, it wasn't anything even approaching a normal distribution. It was like a hugely variable response.
To the BHB or?
To the LPS, I'm pretty sure. I'd have to go back and look
at
that.
Yeah, we'd have to go back and look at the paper. I'd be interested to look, because I've started
But go on. Sorry, I sort of interrupted you.
No. I'd be interested to look at that. But the they were also doing some fancy tracer stuff looking at protein synthesis, and they found that having BHB present while when you were giving the stress with the bacterial toxin, it sort of somewhat protected muscle protein wasting. But they looked at cytokines and markers of inflammation that would be downstream of NLRP3, and you'd expect that they would be down, but actually they were actually a little bit higher in the ketone arm. And then sort of 6 months later, or within a few months after that, a paper came out of John Little's group in University of British Columbia, and they were using the ketone ester, the BHB monoester that I worked on. And they took a blood sample, they gave people the drink, and then they took another blood sample. And then once they had those blood samples out, they then stimulated them with LPS.
Yeah, you lost me.
So
I understand what you said. You've lost me with the utility of the test.
So they're now looking at how much inflammatory activity goes on in the blood sample, not in the whole person.
Right.
But there's some crossover because it's the same toxin. We're looking at blood cell white immune cell activation with and without ketones. And again, with the ketones, they saw a boosted inflammatory response when they put the back. So it's interesting because the title of the paper would lead you to believe that ketone drinks were inflammatory. But if I took, if you had a ketone drink and then I took a blood sample, the, in that blood sample itself, there wasn't more inflammation, but it got more, it was more active if I then stimulate it with bacteria, which you could argue is actually a good thing on the one side, because you'd be like, oh, you actually want a big immune response to bacterial toxin. And if at basal, there's no difference, but there was some interesting nuance going on there. And it was clearly counter to this big, you know, fairly well accepted animal mechanism that had been demonstrated a bunch in animal models. So it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out, what's actually going on in those human studies. How can we get at that question a little bit better? And is it just fundamentally different to animals? And, you know, one thing that I'm learning more and more at the Buck is that there's even differences in metabolism between different standard strains of animals. You know, the difference is, first, as you'd expect, between rats and mice, but even there are commonly used lab strains. For example, there's a strain called C56 Black 7 mouse, which is just like a cooking mouse. You know, it's like, it's, a, it's the type that everyone uses, but they have a mutation in transporter called ANT, which is used in the mitochondria for like part of the energy production and ATP shuttling pathway. And that affects their metabolism kind of profoundly. And it, that actually might be relevant to how they respond to ketosis. And you wouldn't necessarily know that if you were just, you know, you're trying to pick a as standard a model as possible. And there's lots of ways that error can come in because these animals are very, very inbred. So yeah, it's all, there's a lot of things that aren't necessarily going to map from animals to humans.
Well, that's what worries me about the bottom-up approach, right? You start with an application that you know that works and then fiddle around in the source code later and figure out why it works.
Yeah.
But first, make sure that it actually works.
Yeah, and I think that actually a good way to guide basic science would be an untargeted approach in the system that you're ultimately interested in. Because it doesn't matter if we can make mice live longer if it's going to help people live longer and healthier.
Or what are the emerging applications? Is there anything that's emerged since the last time we spoke, or maybe that you haven't talked about in the past? That, I mean, there might be a different, you know, there's the Buck Institute are maybe interested in things other than winning triathlons and helping elite warfighters.
Yeah, we're certainly not looking so much at physical performance in young, healthy adults.
Okay.
It's definitely more through the lens of aging and age-related diseases. So, I mean, for example, John's got a paper that's available on bioarchives where he's looked at effect on brain activity in Alzheimer's. So when you have Alzheimer's disease, or in this particular model of Alzheimer's disease, the mice have what's called epileptiform spikes. So random kind of spikes in brain activity that are present in the mice with AD, but not present in normal young mice. And so he saw that ketogenic diet and exogenous ketones could reduce those epileptiform spikes. So he's particularly looking at, like, yeah, brain activity and aging, protein aggregation in the brain, aging. And I mean, these are all things that I guess you and I have talked about a little bit before, maybe from an energy perspective, you know, ketones
rescuing
are really,
an energy crisis.
But I mean, maybe this is a multifactorial intervention here. So looking at that kind of biology, I'm interested in muscle physiology. Ken Ford from the IHMC is super interested in sarcopenia, and it certainly looks that ketones evolve to be profoundly anti-catabolic. So how that might affect aging. And again, to go back to what I said about John's mentorship, he's often talking about the syndrome of fools. So someone falls not just because there was something, a carpet that they little tripped, they then couldn't catch themselves, they then couldn't, you know, it was like a number of things that lead to a fall. And then also downstream of the fall, there's a number of reasons why it's much more serious for an old person to fall than a young person.
You gotta keep asking whys. Five whys, right? Like, ask why five times, you'll find out.
Yeah, I think thinking more about aging, but I actually believe myself that a lot of the discoveries that we make that are relevant to aging will also be relevant to younger people as well. Because, you know, muscle metabolism and maintaining muscle mass is of interest to young people as well in the performance space, but also in the health space. So thinking about cardiovascular disease, there's been a couple of papers come out recently looking at ketone infusion in humans, and then also a recent one from the University of Pennsylvania that looked at ketone infusions again in a paced cardiac model of cardiac failure in beagles and dogs. And they somewhat replicated Richard Veitch's findings and found an improvement in cardiac efficiency in these dogs with the heart failure phenotype, which I think is kind of interesting.
What about status epilepticus? So we've got an anesthesiologist friend in the UK, and he sees people with status epilepticus. I hope I'm saying that right.
Yeah, what is that?
It's just like a constant, so you obviously haven't heard about it then. So it's like a constant seizure.
Huh.
So you can't, you literally can't do anything.
I mean, the ketogenic diet was first used to treat seizures, so I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's an effect there.
Okay, that's okay. It's worth asking. Yeah, so these people have got a nasal gastric tube, so they could just dump the ester.
So that's actually some of what I did at Oxford, was one of the first people to feed the BHB monoester via an NG tube, and you see that you can maintain a steady state of ketone levels.
Okay.
Yeah, we're interested as well in trying to understand, when you measure ketones in the blood, that's a really poor surrogate measure for what's actually going on inside the body. Mm. So the measure in the blood is a sum of what's going in, what's going out.
Right, the flux.
Yeah. And so starting to think a little bit even about the work that I did in Oxford, if you've got 10 units of ketone, you know, arbitrary units in your bottle of ketone ester, and if it's really rapidly bioavailable and you drink that bottle of ketone ester, all 10 units appear in your blood at the same time and you get this big peak, which is what we'd see with the BHB monoester, but then no more is going into the blood. And so it sort of like tails off over sort of 3-4 hours, depending on whether you exercise or not. If you are on either a ketogenic diet or you take something that's releasing into the blood slower, you're not going to see the same high peak, because if you take that 10 units and you drip out 2 units every hour for 5 hours, the level's just going to be lower, but the delivery to the body is the same, equivalent. So it's interesting to us to start to try and understand flux of ketones a little bit better, but it's really difficult to do. You need some kind of isotope labeling study, and those isotopes themselves are expensive and hard to work with. So I don't know how we'll get at that question, but you see this with the ketogenic diet as well. So I was speaking to Drs. Volek and Finney, and they were saying that when you put people on a ketogenic diet, often within the first couple of days, they might have a spike and go into ketosis quite quickly, and then they could stay eating the same diet and their levels go down. This is different for different people, because you definitely have some people where they tick along at a high level, but it's not always the case. And that could be because they're making less, or it could be because they're using more of the ketones. So it's unclear. And Eric Verdin, he's been talking to me about his thoughts on this, and he thinks that the presence of ketones activates BHB dehydrogenase 1, and that would, so even just the presence of ketones would somewhat expedite their clearance. Mm. So, you know, it's another interesting thing that we kind of are thinking about a little bit. But the NG tube is kind of interesting there, because we were infusing a constant rate of ketones, and even by the end of the 9-hour experiment, levels were starting to go down, even though we were infusing a constant amount.
Right.
So I think
that's going somewhere.
Well, yeah, that begs the question whether this is, even in a short term, activating increased metabolism by more exposure. Mm-hmm. We don't know. Got to figure it out.
Do you have any thoughts on the ketogenic diet and gut health? Particular, I was wondering whether you'd looked at butyrate, which is normally a product of colonic fermentation by carbohydrates. Not necessarily the starchy type, mind you, like lots of vegetables.
Fiber,
good. Yeah, exactly. So there's lots of things that are fermentable.
It's really interesting. And I think we could do a whole podcast just about what's going on in the gut with short chain fatty acids. There's a number of things coming out recently that are tremendously interesting. And I think, or I feel like, where we are with the gut is that we're getting better at observing what goes on and not so good at intervening and actually changing what goes on in a way that's sort of meaningful. But butyrate, when we're doing screens of binding to stuff, let's just say, in the lab, butyrate's often a much more potent activator of a lot of receptors that ketones also activate, or a lot of things that ketones also bind to. So it's possible that butyrate itself might be a kind of juiced up version of BHB for certain applications. And so I mentioned that BHB can bind to receptors and butyrate can bind to those receptors. And for example, G protein coupled receptor 41 and HCAR2, the other receptor that we know that BHB binds to, those are found in the gut. So it's likely that there's an effect of the presence of ketones in the gut. In fact, there was a paper, this will not be correct by the time this goes out, but it was published last week, looking at intestinal stem cell regeneration and the balance between stemness and differentiating into a secretory phenotype. And they put these mice on ketogenic diet, and then on a different condition, they also fed the mice with exogenous ketones, and they were looking at what happens to the gut intestinal stem cells, and they were seeing differences. They were seeing an increased stemness, less secretory. There was also an effect on some kind of maybe some kind of like also inflammatory response as well. It was an interesting paper. There's definitely effects of having ketones in the blood, because it now appears that stuff that's in the blood can get into the gut lumen, which is kind of neat.
Also, that was going to be my question, you know, if butyrate is an essential fuel for the colonocytes and that helps them maintain the barrier function, and then you change your diet such that the substrate for fermentation and hence butyrate production goes down, like could beta hydroxybutyrate
be an alternate
fuel? And then especially I'm thinking about, well, if I can just raise beta hydroxybutyrate with the ester, then
I think it'd be really interesting. I know that people are asking these questions, and I think people there'll probably be papers coming out in the next few months or
but it makes physiologic sense to you.
Yes, the closest comparison that we have right now is there was a paper in Nature that looked at propanoate in elite
runners,
another short chain fatty acid, and they saw that lactate from the blood could cross into the gut lumen and be metabolized by enterocytes into propanoate, and which could then go back into the blood, and the propanoate itself was having a performance effect because they could give a propanoate suppository and get the same performance effect that they could with lactate. It was a very neat paper. And again, another one. It got a lot of media airtime because they had runners that were doing the Boston Marathon giving stool samples as well, and they saw that propanoate producing bacteria was enriched in runners after they'd run the marathon.
I looked at that paper, you sent it to me. I hadn't even heard of the bacteria.
It's a really neat paper because they have the mice on the treadmills and the runners doing the Boston Marathon. So that's kind of neat. So if it works the same with butyrate and beta hydroxybutyrate as this model, then there's definitely some interesting potential for improving gut function, gut barrier function. But we do know that when people go on ketogenic diet, that causes shifts in bacterial abundance that might be deleterious.
Yeah.
But the moment we don't know, we're just like, oh, it causes a shift up in this bacteria.
And as Lucy Mayling pointed out on the podcast recently, that I think a lot of what is suggested to be a healthy gut microbiota is a healthy gut microbiota in people who are eating a totally different diet. And we don't know, like, could there be another signature of health that occurs in people eating a ketogenic diet? It seems entirely possible.
Yeah, you should go and check out the paper with the intestinal stem cells and the BHB. People need to go and they need to go into the supplementary methods on the page one. And there is the most beautiful molecule I've ever seen in my life. They've made a cyclical ring of BHB joined together and it looks like a snowflake. And it's so pretty. I saw it and I got so excited. And I was like, no, now you know you're a full nerd. You're getting like, you've got a crush on a cyclical BHB molecule.
I hope you emailed them to tell them, because
I printed it out and I have it on my office wall. Yeah.
So obviously you can't tell me then, oh, if you're having gut problems and you've got low butyrate producing bacteria in your gut, like, can I just drink the HVMN ketone ester and bring those butyrate levels back up? You can't tell me the dose.
We don't know whether, I mean, it's so rapidly hydrolyzed. I wonder if it even Well, yeah, the ketone ester itself is pretty rapidly hydrolyzed. Mm. So I don't know whether which bit of the gut it's important that it gets to, if it would be getting there, or if the fact that it would raise blood ketones and then that would get into, you know, I couldn't answer your question just yet. Who knows?
Okay.
We need some more science.
Is there anything you've changed your mind on over the past 5 years, specifically to ketones?
Well, I'm interested in this inflammation thing. I'm prepared to be wrong
really?
About that.
Really? Yeah. I thought the data was pretty sketchy, but that's interesting.
What, you mean it's sketchy in which direction?
I thought it was just like the experiment. Like, I think it's like one of those things. It's like you found the opposite of what the predominant theory is. And it's the way that you did your experiment, not you found something the opposite.
I don't know. I have to see. That's something I'm prepared to be wrong about. What have I changed my mind about? Yeah, and then definitely changing my mind about chasing a ketone number. I'm starting to get to a point where I'm like, that is not important.
Right.
We need to understand the flux.
You mean that the Volek and Finney cartoon thing? Like the first time I saw it, I said, that's a cartoon. I don't think there was data that generated that optimal ketone.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between optimal. I just don't think it really tells us that much. And so I'm getting to a point where, so from my background as well with the exercise science, I'd have always been very much like, we need to get to a certain level of blood BHB to have a performance effect. Uh-huh. And I mean, that does seem to be the case. It'd be interesting. I mean, I don't know how much I want to say this, but we need people to replicate the performance study result that we had with the HVMN product, with the HVMN ester done in Oxford.
Right.
Firstly, because that's the only positive performance study with the monoester. Brendan Egan's group ran a running trial. The ketone levels weren't all that high, and there wasn't a performance benefit.
Right.
So we need to start figuring out what the dose response is for performance, if that is a robust performance effect. I'd say, you know, I'd still like 100% hand on heart say that the metabolism, exercise physiology is very, very different in the presence of ketones. But performance, we need to replicate that more, and that's what athletes are interested in. Maybe look more at the difference between athletes. One thing that I'm really interested in as well, and I don't know whether I've changed my mind on this, or whether maybe I just haven't made up my mind, whether or not ketone esters is a good idea or not for athletes on a ketogenic diet, because it does provide energy as BHB, but it also inhibits lipolysis acutely, and that's a big provider of energy for the ketogenic athlete. So, and we've had, when I was at HVMN, we had some athletes who felt like it really helped who were on a ketogenic diet, and then a couple of athletes who felt like they were bonking. So I mean, it wasn't consistent. So I don't really feel like, even from the anecdotes, that I could get a handle on that. So that's something that I'm prepared to change my mind on, or not made up my mind on just yet.
Do you think there are any applications where measuring blood levels of ketones is a valid thing to do?
I mean, sport performance, it looks like it might be. Alzheimer's disease, it looks like it might be, because Dr. Cunane's done some studies looking at correlating, you know, again, it's only one study. It could just be a random correlation, but they saw a correlation between blood ketone level and change in cognitive function and brain ketone uptake. So
what about for weight loss?
Weight loss, I don't think so.
Okay. And then, so what do you think about these proxies for blood BHB, like the breath acetone meters? They're all the rage, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, people just don't want to finger prick themselves and understand that. It doesn't tell you what your blood BHB is, but if we think that blood BHB isn't in itself that useful, then it's just another thing that's kind of medium useful, giving you an idea of some kind of idea into your...
Do you think the breast acetone tells you something about how much fat you're burning?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that that's been, from what I've seen of the data, that's quite sensitive and has been demonstrated. I think it's more accurate at lower concentrations of acetone. And it doesn't necessarily map onto what's happening in the system when you take exogenous ketones. Yeah, you know, like, it's not my field, so I'm perfectly happy to be like proven wrong on that one. But from what I've seen of my understanding of ketone biology and acetone conversion, and I've read a few of the papers and talked to a few of the companies, and I'd say that's different to blood BHB, but all right.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you expressing your opinions. We're totally winging it here. Bree's here for the triathlon, and I agree to give
it's the price I have to pay to camp at Chris's house.
I know it causes some scientists tremendous anxiety when they don't know what they're going to be asked. And then just to pull you all over the place like that, it's like you're a really good sport. So Bree is like shooting from the hip here. She's got absolutely no notes or anything. Like, I really appreciate
you. Make it sound like I don't know what I'm talking about. I actually do know what I'm talking about.
I know that.
Some of the time. Heavily caveat things I don't know about. Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to record with me, Bree. How do you think you're going to get on? Are you going to win your race tomorrow?
I don't know. I feel like I'm in really good shape, and I've done quite well in the other ones I've done. But there are a lot of triathletes in Northern California, and so there could be some other good people out there. So I have to distill it down into what performance do I want to do for myself, because I can't really control who else is there and where I'm going to place. And it's not like a tactical thing like cyclocross racing where I would be following people. I won't know who my opposition are.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, even cyclocross, you could argue, is not super tactical, but yeah, I mean, with the way the conditions are right now in Northern California, it's like super dry and bumpy. And so, yeah, if the group goes, you have to go with him, else you ain't going to see him again.
Yeah,
but that's not true. The opposite's true, right? You get as we talked about last time, you get penalized if you jump on a wheel and follow.
Yeah, we talked about that last time. So I'm going to try not to get a time penalty.
Yeah,
I have a few like process goals. So I want to feel good and confident and strong on the swim. Again, it's hard to put a time goal on that because the conditions will vary a bit. But I think the feeling of being in control and confident is what I'm looking for on the swim. On the bike, I have a power goal because, again, you can't, it was quite windy today. So
speed is terrible. Like, on highway one.
I do have a time goal that I would like to do, but if the wind's there, then it more like focus in on power. And so I have my power goal, and then the run I haven't got a specific goal for, but I think the goal is always to run as hard as I can. And then if I have a strong swim, screw myself over on the bike, and then can hold on the run, I think I'll probably do quite well. I think that I'm like of a caliber of athlete, and I hope that I'd be like top five, and then we'll see. It'll be interesting to see where I shake out according based on everyone else. It's always a bit intimidating wandering around the village, checking in on the bike, and everyone looks super athletic and everyone's got these super expensive bikes. But, you know, I used to actually do these on my road bike before I had a triathlon bike, and I used to go blaze past some people, and that was always kind of fun. And now I'm a nerd with the bike as well. So maybe, you know, I think there's a certain amount like to be said for the athletic mindset, and I know I can push myself. And so, you know, I'm excited.
You've been working on your athlete identity. I think you already had an athlete identity from your rowing days.
Yeah. I'm revising it, updating it, new and improved.
Well, I'm sure you'll do great. You're certainly very, very organized.
We can update the show notes with my position.
Exactly. So come and find the show notes over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. Also, Elaine does a really fantastic job of tracking down all of the scientific references that
Lucky
Brie,
Elaine. Yeah, all of Elaine, these ones I've been throwing out. I know she does a great job. That's why I'm throwing them in, because I'm trying to give her as much information as possible so she can link them all. But people have got to go and look at that cyclical BHB oligomer.
Okay.
It's very beautiful.
We'll find that.
I'll show you later.
And where can people find you online? Do you still have an online presence?
I'm on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Twitter is the best way to follow me and find me. And I try and respond to questions when people ask and stuff. So yeah.
Good for you. Thank you.
Yeah. It's nice to speak to people and get challenged and think about things in a different way. That's what we're looking for.
That's great. Well, thanks so much for your time, Brie. I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Cheers.